to everyone. We're just about to start. Continue with Qoheleth, chapter 2. And we'll start just about one moment. Any of the previous classes, we do post them online, and that will be found in the audio section of the Masorah website. And today we'll be continuing from verse 16. It's 2:16 in Qoheleth. Okay, JHS, thanks for the audio confirmation. Today.
Hi, good morning, Rabbi.
How are you doing there?
Good morning.
Good morning, good morning.
Good morning to everybody, I've got to say. That means good week.
I think Josh is on too.
Okay, hey Josh, how are you?
Hey, good, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
Josh is on too.
Okay, if anybody's on the phone, turn off your speakers on your computer so there's no feedback.
Right.
Okay. All right, so we're up to verse 16. So let's read it. So King Solomon goes on and he says, well, actually we can't read 16 alone because he starts off with the word because or for, which is a continuation of the previous thought. So let's just get the flow from the previous, from 15, and he remarks, and I said in my heart, this is 15, chapter 2, I said in my heart, as what occurs to the fool also will occur to me. And therefore, why have I become wise and any more than the fool? And I spoke in my heart that this was also futile. Okay, are you hearing the static too, Doug, or just am I the only one hearing that?
No, I am hearing it as well.
Okay, let's see if it persists.
I hear it as well, yes.
We'll see if it persists.
Okay,
let's see. So he says in his last statement that since one event happens to both the fool and to the wise person, meaning himself, so therefore why did I toil to become so wise? So there he's saying that, again, if we're looking at this, meaning if we're assessing the value of life just based on what happens under the sun, meaning the earthly existence, so then yes, then he's got a justifiable argument. But of course, we know that he doesn't hold of this. He knows of the world to come. He knows of the eternity of the soul for a person who's perfect. But he's voicing this. He's vocalizing these thoughts, like we said a number of times, in order to allow the reader to identify, and that these these unconscious feelings or these preconscious feelings can finally surface, and the reader can admit to his agreement with these, literally read verses. And now once that's out in the open and the reader can say, yeah, I feel that way, then that can be criticized. So he first brings out that feeling, which of course he doesn't hold, but he knows what other people do hold, because that's what he sees people doing in life, is running around after the physical, and that's why he used himself as a physical experiment. And he experimented with wine and with success and ambition and so on. So he also talks about the feelings that a person might have, and of course most certainly does have, and he sees that this is the mindset of people, that they have a question, and yeah, fine, I can involve the wisdom and so on, but we're both going to die. I'm going to die just like the fool, so what real gain have I obtained? So he says that that is this is hevel, this is futility at the end of verse 15. The reason why it's a futility is because the person is assessing existence purely based on the assumption that at death there is nothing subsequent for the for a person, which is false. Okay, so that's why he goes on to the next verse in 16, and he says, based on this idea, now I'll say the following thing, says King Solomon, because there's no remembrance to the wise person with the fool forever. For when the days and the coming days have already passed, all is forgotten. And how can it be that the wise man will die with the fool? Again, he now brings in a new concept. He says, for there is no recollection of the wise man with the fool forever. For when it has already happened, the coming days have passed. Meaning when the future finally comes and it goes and it fades into the past as all time does, all is forgotten. Period. And he concludes this verse and he says, therefore, how can it be that the wise men will die with the fool? And in 17, he now remarks on that and he says, and, meaning a continuation, and I hated life, for it was evil upon me, this work that is done under the sun. Because everything is futile and a vexation of spirit. So what is he doing now? What is he adding from what we discussed previously last week? What is the new lesson? All right, look,
he seems to be focusing on the remembrance of someone after they die.
Okay, good. Last week, in that series of verses from like 13 through the end of 15, he was talking about how there were a couple of steps that the person made when comparing the wise man to the fool. On the one hand, having wisdom outweighs foolishness, just like light outweighs darkness. On the other hand, that was 13. On the other hand, in 14, he says, but now when I look at that, I also see that that may be true, but on the other hand, there is one occurrence that happens to both the fool and the wise man. They both die. So now, when I put that into the formula, and I start evaluating what is better, I can't escape the truth that there's going to be the same exact event will terminate the fool and the wise man. Both will die. And if I leave my assessment limited to the earthly sphere under the sun, then you're right. Then it's going to be something which is, it would seem to be futile, a futile pursuit to become wise. But then he goes on and he says that there's no remembrance to the wise. But why is he bringing that up now? Why is he, you're right. Remembrance is now the new point, the new topic. But for what reason does he bring it up? And if anybody, unless you're speaking, yeah, just put your mute button on so there's no feedback. Okay. So again, so what is the reason he brings up remembrance now?
Is it possible that he's tackling now a new issue, which is the person who will say, well, okay, so the same thing happens to the righteous man that happens to the wicked man, they all die, but after death, the righteous man's going to be remembered and the foolish man will be forgotten, so there is in fact some usefulness in this.
Right. He's looking for since he can't be satisfied with his own existence because it's really going to end if I feel that the whole existence does end at death, the physical death. So then he's looking for some last vestige of hope where there is some value. Is there perhaps value here that I'll be remembered? But if you think about that, we have to be honest, if you think about that, isn't that a foolish statement? Because you want to tell me that maybe there'll be some benefit in the fact that the wise man will be remembered. But then he says, no, even that's forgotten. But let's just question his premise. Is that really is that an intelligent statement or not? To say that at least there will be some benefit because I will be remembered.
And if the person's existence ended at death, then their remembrance only occurs after that point. So, they're not even in existence to have any benefit.
Exactly. Very good. So the underlying idea itself is really, if you say that the person terminates completely, so there is no person after death that would derive benefit from the remembrance. So you see, this is really a fantasy of a person that he wants to go down to history, he wants to be immortalized. And people really buy into this, and they say, I'm going down to history, and there is some benefit to that. But they don't stop to think that if they really feel that death is a termination completely of your existence. So if they would stop to think about that, then they would not care about being immortalized. But they can't accept that. They can't accept that concept. So they sense that there's going to be a continuance of themselves somehow. It's an inability to view the self as not there, because that is an impossibility. Maybe that's what the Rav Soloveitchik, I saw a video, and he was making a statement where he says he cannot imagine the world without his existence. Perhaps what he was saying is that you know, a person who's foolish will take that superficially and say that the Rebbe was saying that there's no meaning to the world without me here. But that's ridiculous. You know, the Rebbe was one of the greatest minds of the last hundreds of years. Was not saying something so foolish. Perhaps what he was saying is that there's an impossibility for a person to do an act of imagining, and in that very imagination, he is not there. Because imagination means I am there doing the act of imagination. So I can't imagine not existing. It's impossible. It's like saying, imagine you can't think. Well, you can't do that because the very act of imagination means you're putting your mind to a task right now. So it's a mutually exclusive type of a phenomenon. It can't occur. So when the person here is assuming, you see, he has this feeling that there'll always be something. There'll be some benefit. I can imagine people. I mean, because right now, I can imagine people thinking about how great I was. What a great philanthropist. What a great president. What a great leader. I can imagine that right now. So a person feels that is going to continue. So the flaw is, though, if he's of the opinion that death ends everything, so then he hasn't really come to terms with that. You hear what I'm saying?
Yeah, that makes sense, Rabbi. Yes. Okay. That makes sense.
Rabbi, can I ask a slightly different question?
Sure, go ahead.
So, on the subject area between 15 and 16, Rashi seems to take an interesting position that I agree with what you have just said. On the part at the end of 15, where it says this to is futile, he indicates what's futile is to think they share a common fate. For though the righteous man and the fool both die, the righteous man is remembered with veneration, whereas recollection of the fool will evoke nothing but contempt. And then he goes on in 16 and says, fools are soon forgotten, but recollection of the righteous goes on benefiting their offspring forever. And he cites two verses to support that.
Yeah, I didn't understand it. I read that. He says that in 16, he says that on the words, for there's no remembrance, but let me just repeat one more time just so it's clear that this verse 16 is now coming after the acceptance that, all right, fine, there may be an equal end to both the wise man and the fool, but maybe there's some, and that itself is something which is bothersome, right? But maybe I can grab at some straw over here and say that there'll be remembrance and there will be some benefit. So you see, the person's still looking for some worth in what he did in his life. Well, maybe if my life ends, that's it. So now he's agreeing that the life itself is over. So the personal is, meaning the benefit derived from me now that I would appreciate is gone because we both end. The fool and myself have an equal end. But maybe there's some benefit in the fact that there's a memory. That means the benefit is now, perhaps he's saying, to others, which would then answer my question, meaning what Josh had brought up. Meaning the remembrance would be, and this would be more consistent, I feel, with the path that King Solomon is taking, because if he's taking the path that at death, it completely terminates the human existence. There is no soul. So if that's the position, so it would then make sense for him to say, well, maybe there'll be a benefit for others. Then you could say that, because now, if you're saying that the soul is gone, of course there's not going to be any benefit to you in terms of memory. So perhaps we could revamp what the projected benefit is in 16, and it's not a benefit to me, I'm gone, but maybe there's a benefit to others. But then he critiques that and says, nope, because even that is really not true, because everything is forgotten. But Rashi seems to be saying otherwise, right? At the end of 15, Rashi says, "V'dibarti b'libi, I spoke in my heart. She'im ha-hurricane, if I think so, it is futility. Because there is no remembrance of the wise man with the fool. that is equal. Because he says, after their death, they are not remembered together, because this one is remembered for good, and this one is remembered for evil. So what is he saying? Let's just take the first Rashi and see if we can understand that. And then we'll go to the next Rashi, which is another difficulty. So what is Rashi's position? Let's take a moment here.
I mean, I suppose you could argue that at the time of their death, you know, people go back and eulogize a righteous person and talk about its righteousness and so forth. And that they won't do that for the fool. But if he wants to hold that they're remembered, I mean, who can remember a righteous person three generations back? I mean, maybe a few that made it into the history books or something will make it, but, you know, I would say probably the vast majority of righteous people are unknown within a relatively short time after they die.
Right, but we do know that we're talking about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and so on. So we do have memory.
Right, but it's an incredibly small handful. Now, if that's what he's getting at, I accept his point.
Right, now I think that is what he's getting, he's talking about. But what he's saying, if we read the Rashi again, this is how you have to read it. You have to read as follows. And I said in my heart that it was futile. I mean, the last words of the previous verse, of 15, is, these last words are v'dibarti b'libi, and I said in my heart, shigam z'hevel, that this too is futile. So Rashi says on that, meaning to say, that if I think in my heart that it's a futility, right, that's really what's wrong. That if I think it's futile, that's wrong, because there is no comparison. The righteous man is remembered for good, and the evil man is remembered for bad. So what he is saying, King Solomon is saying, is that if I think that there's going to be an equal occurrence of death, and that's all, so that's a futility. Because there really is going to be a difference. The righteous are going to be remembered for good, and the evil are going to be remembered for bad. So to make an assessment that the death now neutralizes the value of the wise person is a wrong thing. That's what Rashi is saying here. Again, Rashi says that if I think in my heart so, meaning so is referring back to that statement, that there's an equality at death between the wise and the fool. There's a complete equality. If I think so, right? So then that's the wrong thing. That's hevel. So Rashi says, if I think this way, hevel, that's a futile statement. Why? Because there is not a equal remembrance of the wise man and the fool after the death, because they are not remembered equally. Because this one's remembered for good, and that one's remembered for bad. So to say that there's an equality of death is a wrong thing. That's what Rashi's saying is the interpretation. You see it?
Yeah.
Okay. Then he goes on, though. And then he says, well, let's see if he follows through. He says, the next Rashi, for there's not a remembrance of the wise man with the fool forever, when the future finally comes and passes. All is forgotten. And how is the wise man able to die with the fool? Let's see what Rashi says on this. So Rashi says, because I see the wicked that were very successful, and all of their great successes were forgotten. And then he goes on and he says, and I see the righteous that they're very successful, and in their death they are helpful to their children, as it says. God says, I will remember my treaty with Jacob, with Isaac, and with Abraham. So he's following through on his original notion from the previous Rashi that there is a superiority of the righteous. So according to Rashi's interpretation, it's a critique. I mean, he's saying something which is really a futility. don't think this. He says it, but then he says this is not a true thing. Because the person will say in 16, if you just read the verse, there's no remembrance of the wise man with the fool. All is forgotten. No, he's saying that's a wrong idea. So you can read that verse either being a true assessment, or you could read the Rashi's reading that as being a, he's telling you something which is false. He's verbalizing the views of people that are false. Okay, that's one way to interpret. All right, but how we're interpreting it differently. We're saying that a person will have a certain remorse at the fact that there's going to be an equality of death. And that's based on the assessment just on earth. But then a person looks for the hope in 16 of maybe there being some benefit afterwards. But he's saying that even that's all forgotten. So, of course, he's not denying the fact that God says he remembers the treaty that he made. So, but it seems to be he's taking it in terms of the norm. The normal case, we're not talking about outstanding characters that survived the, you know, millennium and they're still known to us today. We're talking about the typical person, that everything is forgotten. So for a person to look for his own, to look for some benefit in his existence, because again, the person is, he is trying to assess the benefit in existence itself. So if in 15 we conclude that in as much as I was in existence, and so was the fool, but we both end the same way, so that's worthless, who cares, he lived a couple of decades. Ultimately, you're both gone, then what value is it? But then he says, well, maybe there's some benefit to others that they'll have a remembrance of us. But he says, no, the typical case is that you won't be remembered after a while. So even that is not a good assessment. So therefore, he says in 17, therefore I hated life. And he's very clear what he's hating. He's saying that, therefore I hated the assessment of man if we just base it on what is under the sun. Because he says, for the whole work is evil under the sun. Everything is futile and a vexation of spirit. Okay? And just in case you're joining the class late online, you know, in case you're joining the class late online, so the whole class will be in its entirety on the audio link, so you can hear from the beginning. We'll put it there after the class. Okay. All right, so there's two approaches that we have here. Two approaches regarding what the assessment is. Right. And you see in Tes Zion, in 16, if you read it again, just the last words, we can pick up on something more now. He says that, okay, if I look now for some benefit in the fact that there's a remembrance of what I've done, and there's a benefit there, right? This is no, there's not even a remembrance of the wise man with the fool. That when the future finally elapses and it fades into the past, all is forgotten. And then he says, how can it be then that the wise man will die with the fool? So why does he bring that in again? That he, we thought he concluded that already at the end of 15. In terms of assessing the life itself, well, if both the wise man and the fool die together and they have the same event visits them both, so that's it in terms of the individual. Then he moves on to 16 about, well, maybe there'll be a benefit in the remembrance of the actions of the wise man. But that's for other people, he said. So why is he now going back at the end of 16 and saying that how could it be that the wise man will die with a fool? What does that have to do with remembrance?
Is he potentially just restating the idea
could be that what he's telling you is that the reason why the remembrance is not going to be of any benefit is due to the primary cause of death visiting both the wise man and the fool. I mean, the reason why it is not going to be, in the beginning of 16, it says, if you would think that there's going to be some benefit in the remembrance, he says, no, there's no remembrance of the wise man with the fool. Because once every time passes, everything's forgotten. So the reason why everything is forgotten is because the event of death took place. He's telling you that the events, he's talking about primarily, what is the primary cause that remembrance doesn't take place? Because death took place, that event is what he's addressing. So he's trying to go back to the core issue that memory is only becomes an issue once the event of death is there. Right? It's a dependent phenomena. To have a recollection, to feel that a person might be immortalized, is dependent upon the fact that there is an event of death. So perhaps that's why he goes back, to show you that that's really the core issue of why the memory doesn't take place. Now let's think. Let me just think for 1 second. Unless also he's saying is that once we've now removed the assumption that memory does offer some benefit, now that we show that everything's forgotten and really there is no recollection of the typical person, so now he goes back and he says, therefore my very existence, how can it be then? So what's the whole purpose of the existence then? So he concludes that thought, well, if there's no help for anybody else, that means my whole existence was nothing. So he was trying to justify his existence by saying, well, maybe I died with the fool, but maybe my existence has some value because there'll be a memory for other people and they'll derive something from it. But once I show that the typical person is not remembered, right? So now he has to go back and now concludes his original thought that therefore there really is no real hope. There is no real benefit then. How could it be then that the person who is a wise man will die with a fool? I've tried to justify his existence by itself. That didn't work. I tried to give some last vestige of benefit to his life, or my life, by saying that at least my existence will have some memory and it'll affect other people. Maybe there's a benefit over there. But once I see that's not true, that's a very short-lived amount of time that people recall who you are. So once I see that's no good, so now I reflect back on my very existence, I say, therefore, I conclude 100% now that the whole existence was useless. That's why he goes back at the end, you see? Because this was a continuation, trying to, one last effort, one last ditch effort to justify his existence. But if I can't justify it by saying that my memory will benefit other people, therefore I have to conclude that my very existence was useless. That's what he says. How could it be then that the wise man will die with the fool? And therefore, I hated life, because life itself now became, now 17, is where he makes a statement, and he says, he surmises, and it's a summary, and he says, therefore, and I therefore hated life, because it was evil upon me, this matter that takes place under the sun. All is futile, and it's just a vexation of spirit. There's no benefit. Okay, so it's very smooth now how it works out. And just to reiterate what Josh was saying before, so the problem that we said was, we assumed this could be how the person was asking me. When King Solomon was saying in 16 that, well, maybe there's some benefit in my life, that even though I do die with the fool, and there's a finality, but maybe there'll be some benefit to me in the fact that I'll be remembered. But then we realized, how could there be a benefit to you if you're not in existence anymore? So therefore, that's a false statement. That cannot be. I mean, even when you're questioning, so there have to be certain correct premises you're working with. So like a person can't say, based on the fact that I'm a bird, I'm only going to eat this amount today. Well, you can't talk about how much you're going to eat today because it's based on a false statement. You're not a bird. So based on the fact that I'm going to be somewhat still able to perceive my memory, will there be any benefit to others? But we have to stop? No, you can't say that, because there is nothing left of you around to have the benefit of a memory. So therefore, we have to throw that notion out, and we have to, that's what we introduced the correct answer. And that is that he's not talking about a benefit to him anymore in 16, right, in the beginning. He's talking about the memory, the benefit of to others. So therefore, he's saying that maybe my existence didn't justify for me, but maybe it is justified, my existence is justified, because others somehow benefit. But then he sees that that's such a short-lived thing, that's really not worth it. So therefore, he goes back, and he says that my existence in the whole. And that's what he says, I hated life in 17. You need to say that if this is how the person assesses his value, again, limited just to their earthly existence, so you're right, a person has to come to this conclusion. But that's exactly what he's trying to bring out over here, is that these are the fallacies that people live with. But he helps the reader by vocalizing those things that they really sense they are carrying around with them, and he wants to bring it out into the open so he can expose to every person these flawed ideas that they have. But the method he's using is to say something as if he actually agrees with it. That allows the reader to now feel justified in recognizing he has this notion. Oh, if this king could have this feeling, therefore, yeah, you're right. I have that too. So that's the method he brings it out, which is it's wise. And I don't know if we mentioned this once, but when the 12 spies came back after searching out the land, and God never told them to go search out the land. He just said, go in and take it over. But 10 of those 12 spies, they had come before Moses, and they said that we want to spy out the land first. They said that because they were insecure. They could not be convinced of God's promise. They wanted to use some military maneuvers in order that they work within, you know, they're pragmatists. They couldn't really depend on God 100%. So they came back and they saw the size of the people and the strength of the people, of the inhabitants of the land of Canaan, which became Israel. So they were frightened and they incited a riot. And then the only two righteous people were Joshua and Caleb. So Caleb told the people, Rashi says, Caleb gets up in front of the people and they're all frightened and they're buying into the plan of these scared 10 spies, and they're inciting a riot, and they don't want to be the only ones that look like they're afraid, so they start getting the people to join them. Yeah, we can't go in, there's giants there, and they're we're like grasshoppers in their eyes, and you know, and it's a strange land, look at the size of the fruit. I mean, they really were very successful in getting the people very frightened to cover up their own insecurity. They didn't want to be the only 10 people that were saying we can't do it. So they incited a riot to get more people. Now it was a movement. Now we're not the only ones with this opinion that we can't take over land, but the whole people are with us. So everybody rebelled against God. But Caleb and Yeshua didn't. Those two spies. And Caleb got up and he stood up and he said to the people, is that all that Moses did to us? So he quieted the people down because he used a method of fooling the people. Rashi says that the people now thought that Caleb was going to add on more things that Moses did that were evil to us. Is this all he did? Not only does he want to bring us into this land where we're going to get eaten alive, but is this all he did? When he said those words, when Caleb said, is that all Moses did? The people wanted to hear more because they were now in a frenzy against Moses. So he used the flow of their energies to get them to listen up. And then he says, this is all he did? But then he told them, didn't Moses bring us the man and split the sea and do all these things for us? So he was trying to get them to see that they were wrong about following the spies. But the first step was that he had to get these people to listen to him. So that's what King Solomon is doing also. He's allowing the reader to listen and to allow the reader to feel, yeah, I do have that feeling that life is worthless if this is this and that is that, and if we assume all these false notions. But in order to tell a person that your idea is false, you can't just walk over to them and say you have a false idea. They'll deny. They'll be defensive, and they'll reject that they even have that feeling. Then you have a brick wall in front of you. you won't be able to work with them. But if you allow the person to say, it's all right, these feelings, are, other people have them too. So then the person feels, oh, really? Well, yeah, you're right then. I do have these feelings. And once the person admits that he has that notion, then he can't backtrack and say, no, I didn't really say that. Now that it's out in the open, then Kisan will now let the person analyze, and that is, it's true or not. So you see the method he's using.
Yes.
Right. And Chaim is asking that King Solomon's conclusion is incorrect. Since Hashem created me and gave me existence, there must be a positive reason for his existence. Yes, you're right. There is a positive reason, but it can't be assessed if we just look at life as something which completely ends at death. That's what King Solomon is trying to bring out. If you assess life where it ends at physical death, then you're going to have a problem with looking for value, because you're going to see that there's a complete equality. The wise man who toils over Torah his whole life dies just like the fool. It seems to me they have the same exact ending. So if you assess it just based on under the sun, so then you'll end up with the conclusion that there is no reason for my existence. Therefore, we have to come to a conclusion, but that'll take, you know, we have still a number of chapters. But we know, we can fast forward. We can already say that the conclusion is that we know that there's existence after this existence on Earth. So there is a purpose. If we live properly, there's reward in the next world. Yes, you have a question?
Rabbi, I just have to get this in, it's bothering me. Is it true that if a person feels a certain amount of guilt or fear that they're not living the correct life, that this is what is instigating this kind of feeling, that, because if somebody has been talking and moving up, they have faith and they have trust, and they believe in this, in the miraculous, Allah Baba, then they know that, there is a hereafter, and if they live the correct life and they set an example for people to follow, that they have a direct link to the people here, and that they will be remembered, and it won't be the end. There will be a continuance, so to speak. I mean, to me that makes sense. Am I on the right track?
No, because the typical case is that he's saying that, you know, a few hundred years from now, we're not going to be remembered. You know, the people who are remembered are the great leaders or the great wicked people. But the, your typical person, you can't start remembering who lived in Brooklyn 300 years ago. You just don't know. They didn't make it into the history book, so we have no concept who they are. And furthermore, King Solomon is not talking about the fact that a person here accepts the next world. That's not what this verse is based on. This verse is based on the fact that a person does not look at the next world as really reality. He thinks that everything is just under the sun, and once you're done here, you're done. That's how he can. That's the notion that he's exposing over here. Everything he says, when he keeps on saying, and I hated life under the sun, he's hinting to you that if we just allow, you know, if a person allows himself to believe that everything ends here on Earth, there is no next world. That is the framework we're discussing right now. We're not talking about the person who knows about the next world. Okay? That's not the
point. Okay.
The person who knows about the next world is living correctly. He's not. He's critiquing wrong ideas. He's not phrasing a right idea right now.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and Pat in Ohio, we are in Ecclesiastes 2:16-17. All right, that's Kohelis, chapter 2, verses 16-17. But if you missed it, it'll be online after the class. You can go to the audio link. You can hear their class in its entirety. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes, Doug.
So, if we conclude that at this point, basically he's saying, yeah, there's really no difference between the life of the righteous and the life of the wicked, except that what happens afterward is different. That is different to me than what I understood the book was teaching.
He didn't say that, though. He did not say that there is no difference between the life of the righteous and the life of the wicked. What did he just say at the end of 15? And doesn't he say in 12 and 13 and 14 that, there, I mean, actually to be specific, doesn't he say that in 13, and I see that there is a benefit of wisdom over the life of stupidity, of foolishness. Just like there's a benefit of light over darkness. Doesn't he say that there is a benefit? So when he concludes over here that how can the fool die with the wise person, he's talking about that this now casts a shadow on my whole existence. And now I'm going to end up the same. Meaning, based on that, during the life itself, there was something. There was a difference. Wisdom is greater than foolishness, just like light is greater than darkness. However, in 14, he introduces, you're right, on the one hand, the eyes of the wise man are at his head, and the fool walks in darkness. Right? And we explain why that was, because the person who is wise is perceiving. He's involved in perceiving ideas and truths. Where a person in darkness, like Josh said last week, a person who's in darkness is doing just the opposite. He's projecting what he thinks might be in this dark room that he can't see. So he's fabricating. He's living a life of fantasy. So he does say again, he reiterates the point in 14, that a wise man is much better off than a fool. But then he said there's another consideration. There's an event that happens to us both that now causes me to ask a question. But if at the end we have the same ending, now that tells me that there's, you know, it's no use. So, if we say that they both die and they both have the same terminality, so it ended up that there is no, unless that's your question, unless you're saying, you know, why don't you say your question again? Let me hear.
Well, let me slightly rephrase it.
Yeah.
If he's saying, well, it doesn't really matter whether you're wise or foolish because one thing happens to both.
Right.
My argument back to him would be, yeah, it does matter. It's sort of like, if I have to go through an hour in the dentist's office and I can either have an hour of excruciating pain or an hour of relaxation and pleasure, and then, you know, both of us walk out of the dentist's office at the end, I wouldn't say that it doesn't make any difference how I spent that hour.
Well, he's talking about now, if you fast forward, and now both people die, so what was the whole use?
Well, but if I extrapolate that idea to my whole life, I could make an argument, well, if that's all I have,
right,
all I have is this life,
right,
then I might as well spend it in the way that's the most advantageous as to the way that's the most uncomfortable.
Right, but that's not a wise approach. The wise approach, the Perkei Avos says, who is a wise man? The one who knows what the future will hold. Meaning the results of his actions, or what will eventually be. He doesn't assess the value of something on an instantaneous gratification. So he knows that to give value, to really understand the value of something, you have to see the complete life cycle of the phenomena that's in question. So I can't say that getting a painful operation is bad because it's pain, if it'll allow me a longer life without the operation. So therefore I have to assess all considerations. So he's saying the same thing. If I now fast forward this whole existence, very nice. I could sit in the dentist's chair and have no pain, or I could sit there and have pain. So you might say, based on that moment, those few hours, pleasure is preferred over pain. However, let's say the pleasure, I mean, forget the pleasure, but if you fast forward and now both of these people die and there's nothing left afterwards, so now in terms of the scheme of things, There really was no benefit, because you have to look at the entire life cycle. Now, if something comes into existence and then fades away, it was just a little bleep on the radar of all of, you know, the millennium, what use is it? That's what we discussed once, that when a person goes to a cemetery and they're burying somebody, so one of the verses we say is, man, whether he is a day old or if he lives to 1,000 years, he is as one who never existed. Now, that's only half the statement. If we stop there and we say that a person just dies and that's it, so what's the difference if he lived a day or if he lived 1,000 years? If all there is death at the end, it's as if he never existed. And it's a hard idea to think about. We had a problem discussing it the first time around. But the end of that statement is, blessed be God, the one who kills and revives. Meaning, we qualify and we say, no, but if a person revives, if a person has the next world, then there is value. But that doesn't matter how long you live. If you eventually come to an end, so that's it. You can't say after the person's over, well, there was some worth to him. Again, there's no him anymore.
I think the flaw with the dentist metaphor, if you have two guys, you know, one's in pain and one's in pleasure for an hour, then they're both still in existence when they come out of the dentist office and they can reflect on it. So it's not really, doesn't really match up. So you can't say, you know, if we're going to say the existence ends at death, then there's no, you know, the guys aren't around after they die to say, well, hey, it was better that I was in pain or pleasure.
That's exactly the point. Since there is death, that's his whole point, King Solomon says. He says that...
That's what I'm saying. That's the problem with the dentist thing, because the two guys are still in existence when they come out of the dentist office.
Right, exactly. So the flaw is you're assuming that there is a person to talk about the benefit that he had. Yeah, an hour after they left the dentist office, they're alive. But we're talking about the complete existence of man. That's what King Solomon is talking about. You have to look at the fact that both people die, and now if you limit man's existence to earth, so King Solomon is absolutely right. Who cares what he did in his life? At a certain point, both of you are gone. There's nothing to speak about. And your existence is as if you never existed. Because there's nothing around anymore to say, well, at least he had a good life. There's no he anymore.
If all this is saying, basically, in a sense, you know, you should live a righteous life because you'll have a life in the world to come, then why does he spend, 10, 12, or however many chapters going through all kinds of other things if that's the end result?
Okay, good question.
And I guess my second question is, in our study of Proverbs, we've always approached it, and maybe this is just one approach and there are multiple possibilities, we've always approached Proverbs from the standpoint of it being a practical here-on-life book, not about the world to come or what your long-term reward is or anything like that, but what happens here and now. Now, these books are juxtaposed pretty closely in the Tanakh. I'm wondering, is Ecclesiastes about both this world and the world to come, or is Ecclesiastes just trying to tell you that ultimately the life of wisdom is a better life here on this planet, not even taking into account the world to come?
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see, you know, because we're still pretty much at the beginning of the book. If we want to surmise the primary themes of it. I'm not ready to make that assessment, how to label it at this point. Regarding your first question, if having the knowledge of, let's just think for a second, if having the knowledge of, your question is, if having the knowledge of the future world is really necessary, so why don't you just jump to that? Why are we addressing all the specific notions that deal with just earth here, that the false ideas? Let me see how to respond. One second. Give me a moment. Let me see. Pat, you're also asking a question. So in other words, he's saying we have to realize that there is more to our life than here on earth. And once we realize that, we can and should live our life accordingly. Yes, I mean, we have to, Pat. We have to understand that if life is something which is just on earth and it ends after 70, 80, 90 years, so what's the whole purpose? So therefore, a person has to realize that God gave us the opportunity for an eternal existence. We said earlier, not today, but early in the classes, that anything of value has to be something which is eternal. Meaning that which is good, which is of any value at all, is synonymous with what is eternal. And we'll have to go into that more, I see. We have to really discuss that more at length. But again, the statement at the gravesite, we go to a funeral, we say that What is man, whether he lives a day or whether he lives a thousand years, he is like somebody who didn't exist. And once the end comes and now the person's gone, so there's nothing there anymore. So there is nothing to say that, well, at least he had a good life. There's no he anymore, if that's where it all ends. So that's why the statement concludes with, blessed is God, the one who kills and who revives. To show you that, no, there is something, that the existence can be eternal if we live properly. If we spent our lives in connection with things that are eternal, what are the things that are eternal that we can be involved in here? Wisdom, truth, the Torah, ideas of the Torah. So if we're involved with that, then our soul now partakes of eternal qualities. We learn about justice, righteousness, kindness, fairness in business, and understanding ideas and questions and answers, and the mind starts to evolve and to grow. So now you're giving life to the soul by being involved in that which is eternal. If a person, on the other hand, only engages in lusts and physicality and does not have a life of wisdom, so then the mind never attached itself to something which can take it into the next world. I'm speaking descriptively, of course. Now let me just go to Doug's question. Let me just think for one. Give me 1 minute. Okay, just to reiterate his question, if we really cannot see any value in anything unless it's eternal, so why doesn't King Solomon just introduce that idea right at the beginning of the book? Why has he got all these 12 chapters or so going into all these other ideas? Okay, let me think for a moment. I think the answer is, Doug, that he is telling you that now. I'm clear that that's the answer. I mean, he keeps on... It's an obvious answer. He keeps on telling you under the sun. He's intimating to you from the beginning of the book that all these flawed ideas are flawed because the person's only looking at man as who terminates with his earthly existence. So he is telling you that right throughout the book. He's also going through all these different areas, too, because we have to examine the different notions that people have. We have to appreciate wisdom, so that means examining different views. But he's not waiting till the end to tell you that the real value of life must be predicated on the fact you have an eternal existence. That he tells you throughout the book, because he keeps on telling you all of his critiques are all based on under the sun, on man's existence under the sun, meaning if you assess all of these questions and come up with answers based on the fact that man only lives under the sun and he has no other existence, then you're right. Then these questions are good questions. But he qualifies it, and he says all the futilities I'm talking about are futile only while we are under the sun. So he does tell you throughout the book, Doug. You see?
I see what you're saying.
Yes.
But I'm still a little bit troubled, and here's why. My understanding is that in the Torah itself, there is almost no mention at all of the world to come.
Yes.
And I don't even know where the small mentions are, but basically you get the impression going through it that it's not about that. And so presumably there is benefit to living the Torah life here on Earth, not taking into account the world to come, and the sense I get is that we're taught or admonished to focus on this life, not worry so much about the next life. But if Solomon is coming along and saying, well, you know, kind of the wicked and the righteous all get the same thing unless you take into account the next life, that seems sort of thematically in contradiction with the Torah's approach.
No, I'll tell you why it's not true. The Torah itself is not telling you that life in and of itself is a good regardless of whether you live afterwards or not. Because the Torah does know that that is part of the whole existence. We can't ignore the major part of our existence, which is after death. The Torah doesn't say that your life is good if you live a Torah life, regardless of there being an afterworld. It doesn't. It does not say that in the Torah. It doesn't. What the Torah does is it doesn't focus on, and maybe some verses in the book of Daniel. Of Daniel, in another few cases, the Talmud talks about where do we know this resurrection? Where do we know, you know, the next world from? It is mentioned because it is a truth. It has to be there. That's why there are questions in the Talmud. Well, where is it? There has to be some presentation of the fact that man is eternal. But when the Torah, so therefore, it's congruous. It's in consonance with the book of that we're reading now, of Ecclesiastes. They're both talking about the fact that there is a next world. Neither one omits it. Neither one accepts that there's value of just a physical life alone. But don't confuse that with the fact that the Torah is very careful to give 99% focus on this world. When the Torah does that, it's for a very important reason. Because if the Torah would give equal focus to the next world, so what will a person do? He'll just be living his life, going through the motions with his fantasy about the next world, but never, ever really getting involved in what can entitle him to the next world. See, it's a catch-22 almost. Because if what you want is you want a person to really value wisdom in and of itself without any other ulterior motive. If you have ulterior motives, so then you're not involved in study and thought because you enjoy it, per se. You've always got this idea of the next world in the back of your mind. So the Torah can't have a big, you know, billboard on the highway that says, you know, just remember, you got a next world coming. You can't have that so much in focus, because then the person will have this fantasy, what is it, all these different fantasies, what this could be, wow, I'm excited about it. And it takes the energies away from just examining wisdom and digging deep and seeing the beauty of wisdom. So what the Torah has to do is it has to obscure the next world in order that our primary focus is looking at the wisdom and enjoying the wisdom, because that is what exists in the next world. That's all there is. But the only way you can have an enjoyment in the next world is if you trained yourself here to really enjoy chachma, to enjoy wisdom. And how can it be that a person can train himself here to enjoy wisdom? It's only if he's not misguided by false ideas about what the next world is. So the Torah has to create a 99% focus on wisdom and ideas and beautiful thoughts and questions and answers in the book of Proverbs and the book of Ecclesiastes and these very cryptic writings where we delve into it and we have questions and then we get so much enjoyment when we finally see the answer. Wow, that's beautiful. That's a nice idea. That's intriguing. The only way we can have an involvement like that is if we are not distracted by promises of the next world. So the focus has to be the wisdom itself in order that we engage in that without any distraction. And then we finally see God's wisdom. And we become like an Einstein who locks himself in his laboratory for 2 weeks because he's grappling with that idea. And that's all he cares about is, how does this work out? How does that work out? He doesn't care about if he's going to get a Nobel Prize. He doesn't care about if he makes money from it. He doesn't care about the applause that he's going to get at some hall when they give him a big award. He is only concerned with getting an answer to a question because he is really just awed by the question. He sees new ideas at every turn. And that can only happen if that's all his focus is on. So that's why the Torah doesn't talk about the next world so much. Because now that you can focus on wisdom, you can see ideas and really train your mind and spend the decades that are necessary to really open up these ideas of of our leaders, of our rabbis. Now that we can do that, then we now become a mind that can have the best portion of the next world. But if you take the alternative, and that is the Torah talks about every other verse. Don't forget, next world is coming. Don't forget about it. There's this great reward coming. So if that's what the person sees at every turn, so that's what preoccupies his mind, he's going to be thinking about that. And he's going to be thinking, because the person's fear of death and his desire for immortality is so strong that will now become the focus of his life. And he'll never sit and study and actually train his mind to like wisdom. So what will happen to a person like that who's just fantasizing what the next world will be? You know what's going to happen? He won't get the next world because he never spent the time enjoying wisdom. He spent his entire life paying his bills and all his free moments were fantasizing about what this next world could possibly be. All right, so you see? Does that answer your question, Doug?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, let me see. Pat and Chaim have questions on screen. Pat is saying that's what is done in the Christian religion. They focus more on the world to come. By doing so, they miss out on what Hashem really has for them to do here. Exactly, Pat. Very good. And Chaim is saying, Rabbi Sadia Gaon, in his book, The Book of Beliefs and Opinions, goes into answers on redemption and resurrection. Okay, good. Right, but again, the Torah is something which, now that we know that there is an next world, that now validates the existence here. Go back to your previous point, Doug, that the Torah wants a person to have the best life here and in the next world. And if a person lives the life of wisdom, he does have the best life here in the next world. And that's what King Solomon was saying initially in verse 13, where he says, I see that there's a benefit of wisdom over foolishness, just like there's a benefit of light over darkness. That's true. And if the person on the one hand says that with his physical death, there's nothing else afterwards, then King Solomon's right. So why did I want to become wise? I'm going to end up the same place as the fool. However, if a person knows that there is a next world, so now he knows what he's involved in here is of value, because that really gives him his life in the next world. So you have to have the knowledge of the next world. But we have to restrain ourselves from fantasizing about what's going to be, because like the Talmud says, no eye has ever seen it. Now, a person who has got the right lifestyle and he uses wisdom, I mean, both people, whether a person thinks that he's got a terminality at the end of his life on earth, or the person who's correct and knows about the next world, both individuals who use wisdom will be able to function in this life to a far greater degree of happiness than the person without it. All right? So it's necessary for a person to really know that. I mean, if a person realizes that, if he doesn't use wisdom, see, I'll give you an example. If a person goes into, he's sick, and he goes into a room with a bunch of chemicals. Now, you have that person, then you have another person who spent a couple of years studying all the chemicals. Both people have the same sickness. So, of course, the person who studied the chemicals for years and knows the right combinations and the right amounts, he'll be able to come up with an injection that will heal him. Because he knows how the physical world operates. Mercury has this property. Zinc has that property. Vitamin A does this. Vitamin D does that. But if a guy who does not know anything about how the chemicals work and he makes a solution out of a bunch of chemicals and he ejects himself, 9 out of 10 times he's going to kill himself. So that's an example to show you that if you use intelligence in the physical world, which has constant laws, if you use intelligence, you will be able to arrive at solutions to your problems. That means if you understand how to deal with people, and you know that you have to control. And there were times in my life, I know that you're involved in business, and there are certain types of people that you can have arguments with in business, and it'll be worthwhile endeavor. You will come out ahead. And certain people that if you argue with, it's like talking to a wall. And you would have been better off not bringing up the argument, because the person could just blow up at you, and then you'll lose the job, and that's it. So you have to understand, in all areas, whether it's mixing chemicals, whether it's your business life, whether it's psychology, the more knowledge you have and the more control you have over your emotions, that's how much of an improved life you will have here. So that'll work for anybody. That's something which, a person has to be humble to say, I don't know. I have to do more research. I have to understand when is it smart to make an issue of something. When is it better off not to make an issue because by next week it's not going to matter anymore? Is it really worth the aggravation? Is it really worth losing the job? What are the considerations? So a person, of course, is much better off. And that King Solomon said openly. Wisdom is far greater than foolishness and ignorance. Just like light is much better than darkness. There's no comparison. No comparison. But you know, at the same time, we have to realize that we're here temporarily. And we look at our lives. We're halfway through life. We're three-quarters of the way through life. And what is it all for? And this is what King Solomon is doing in his book, is assessing, what is the real value? And if a person realizes that he, at a certain point, it's over and that's it, so then you're right. What use was it being here? But if a person has the right ideas that the creator of the universe told us, and there is, you can have an eternal existence. It doesn't have to end with your earthly existence. So then it's worthwhile to investigate. Well, what way will I be able to have the next existence? And also, how will I have the most successful life here? I mean, you look through history. Somebody was telling me the other day that look at how many people have won the Nobel Prize. He says, look how many Jews and how few, by comparison, other people. That means to say that people were involved in wisdom and intelligence, and they trained their minds. They were able to make new discoveries, and they were able to, overcome personal issues and put things aside and make steps in the right direction. And they were also the happiest people. They really had the most happiness, because happiness doesn't come from following what the rest of the world does. Happiness comes from looking at the human being and looking at all different types of people. Who are happy? What provided the happiness? And that's what King Solomon is doing here. He's assessing where the happiness comes from, where the false ideas are, and where the person gets happiness from. How can a person have happiness on a regular basis? It takes study, and then it takes application to the self. And it means you have to change yourself. I mean, King Maimonides, in his book called the Mishneh Torah, so in the very beginning, he talks about the different personalities of people. Some people get excited very quickly, and some people are very, very meek, and they're very shy. Some people spend the money like crazy, and some people are misers. They hold on to every single penny. But he goes through all the personalities, and some people get upset quick, and some people, they don't get upset even at the biggest thing. But he says every person can change themselves. Just because you have a certain personality type doesn't mean that this is how you will always be. A person has the ability to mold themselves, to change. And for whatever reason God created us a certain way, he's allowing us the ability. The personalities are not set in stone. And if we realize that, we can work on it, and we can follow what Maimonides says, and we can go to the opposite extreme. And, like, for example, a person is very, very miserly with his money, and he realizes that he's got to give charity. So Maimonides says what he should do is go to the opposite extreme, be very, very giving for a while until it balances out, and then he lands in the middle. If a person gets angry all the time, what he should do is control the expression of his anger and never get angry for a while. He's going to have to really be tough on himself, but he can do it. And after a while, he learns control over his anger, and now he balances out in the middle. And now when he comes to a decision in the future, he won't make the decision out of anger. He will now make it based out of intelligence, because he's learned to train his anger. And that can happen in any area. So it's an important thing to see over here. The ideas that a person has initially are not the ones that have to stay with you. And the way you view yourself and the way you behave, these are things that you can work with. So it's another. I'm just talking about this because these are other areas that touch on how life here can be far greater. It's not just in terms of wisdom, but it's in terms of our emotions, our psychology. All right, let me stop here and see if there's any questions or comments.
Yeah, I was just thinking that with all the news that we get on the internet and the reality shows, like a lot of things that King Solomon is saying could be it's apparent to everybody now.
A lot of things that he's saying, what?
People, we see the lifestyles of different people, like, you know, openly, and, you know, we see that everything that he's saying is true. And we have proof from everybody else in society.
Yeah, I mean, we see it. We see the people that are, like Doug mentioned last week, that, you know, the people that are in the business world, what gives them happiness? Because once they get a certain, they become, you know, from mailroom boy, they get promoted to this position. They get to a program coordinator. From there, they become marketing director. From there, they become vice president, then executive vice president, then double, triple executive vice president. Till finally, they become president. But the whole life, these decades that they were doing that, they were never really happy. That's seen in the fact that they had to keep on climbing higher. They fooled themselves into thinking that the happiness will come from financial success. Of course, financial success is good, but it's a means. Because if a person ignores his intelligence and he ignores being involved in wisdom, and he ignores the fact that he has to pay for his sins, if he does all this and he's not following what the creator of the whole universe told us is true, a person has to be unhappy. A person will constantly be unhappy if he ignores. I mean, yeah, the universe operates a certain way because the creator designed it that way. And we are the only religion to have the instruction manual as to how a human being will have the happiest existence. And some people think that, well, if I try to be religious, if I try to get onto the right life, it's just a pain and I have to take my... But it's not a pain. It's because you think that not going here and running there with your friends, whatever it is, that's something that you're used to doing. That's something which, now that you have to curb that type of activity, because now you have to, you know, not work for one day out of 7 days, and now you have to attend temple to go to services each morning.
And your conference will expire in 10 minutes.
So the misconception is that performing the laws of the Torah are painful. It's not the Torah that's painful. It's that when you have to change your direction in life, you have to get used to a new flow of your energies. That takes some conditioning. But if a person looks into each law and he understands, why do I put black boxes on my head and on my arm? What am I doing this for? Yeah, if a person doesn't have the understanding of why he's doing it, it's a foolish activity. Same thing with wearing strings on his clothing. Whatever it is, if a person will look into it, he will find beautiful ideas. Just like if a person looks into science, he'll see how that works perfectly. Well, science was created by God, just like the Torah was created by God. So there has to be an equal amount of wisdom. But a person has to take the time to say, listen, I agree that the doctor's smarter than me, so I'll let him give me an injection. Well, then you should also say, I agree that God is smarter than me, so therefore let me see what he wants out of me in terms of these commands of putting on black boxes, this tefillin, or tzitzis, strings on my body, whatever it is. But if a person is foolish, he's just going to dismiss it and say it's not for me. Well, who's smarter, you or God? I mean, it doesn't... But our society today is not religiously driven. Our society today is plastered with all media saying, be number one, be successful, and that's going to give you happiness. The nice car, the beautiful home, and this vacation. Well, why is it that people who have done all that end up that they're not so happy? That's the $64,000 question. All right, you have class to go to. Rabbi Moskowitz says he's giving class in a couple minutes, so let's wrap it up here. Again, if anybody missed the class, you came in late, it'll be online shortly, so you can go to the audio page on the Masorah site, and you can listen to the whole class in the beginning. It'll have today's date. I see there's one more question. Pat is asking in Ohio on screen, it's painful when God shows us just how wicked we really are, but when we accept that God shows us and truly decide to change that area, then we start on the road to true happiness. Yeah, but it shouldn't be painful to us if we see that we're living improperly. If we come to that knowledge and we realize we're doing something which is incorrect, it's not what God wants, we should be very happy that we came to that realization. Now we've got the opportunity to change and to really be happy and keep in mind also that if you live properly, you know, God will involve himself in your life too. He'll make your earning of a livelihood easier. He's going to help out those people that are living more in line with him. That's his promises. So, and I say this many times to people, there is really no reason to ever despair. There's never a reason to be upset. If your life is going a certain way and you need improvement, you have the answers. You have the ability to do it. And you see that, Maimonides talks about how the people that were on the higher levels, they had riches, they were protected, and God was with them even in their day-to-day business life. I mean, when Laban was cheating Yaakov out of the sheep, when Laban was, he was cheating Jacob out of the sheep. So God worked it out that Jacob became successful. And everything he did, he was successful. And it says by King David, in all his ways, all his actions, they were wise. He used intelligence in all his areas. He didn't just follow, go by the seat of his pants. He didn't just, whatever emotion came up, he didn't follow the emotion. He stopped. He thought, is this a right idea? Is this a wrong idea? Does it make sense for me to do this activity or not? Do I need to get advice from people? He did it. And when he did something wrong, God would send a prophet to him to inform him. He sent Nathan to him when he sinned with Bathsheba. So, and the Talmud goes into it and says it wasn't really a sin in the sense that we think about it. But there was some error. There was some error there. But you see that God will be involved in a person's life. And the only thing is that this society doesn't condition us to think about that on a daily basis. That God is on our minds on a daily basis. Well, he should be. Because he's able to do anything. He can create the entire universe. He can give us a few extra dollars if we need it. So we should not belittle that. And Pat, you're asking one more thing. I guess that what I mean by painful, maybe I should have said, once we see how wicked we are very ashamed of that action. Yes, that's good. And if we're ashamed of the action, then we can make changes. So that's important. It's important to keep that in front of us. And again, I think the best analogy is just like we wouldn't inject ourselves and we rely on doctors that have the knowledge, we also should not just think we know how to be happy, but we should look at what God said. And look what the rabbis taught us. And read their books and spend time learning on a regular basis.
Your conference will expire in 5 minutes.
Nurse, we have to look to the direction that we get from these wise people, especially somebody like King Solomon that God gave him miraculous knowledge overnight at 12 years old. Right? That was a real true event that took place. Okay, so let's wrap it up here. We'll pick up next week. Well, actually, I'll let you know during the week because I know that next week, Sunday, is the Sunday before Passover, so we'll see if time becomes a constraint. So, unless you hear otherwise, we'll be here next week, all right? So I'll send an email out. All right, so that's it for today. We'll pick up then, and I wish everybody a good week.
Thanks, Rabbi. You have a good week, too.
You too, Rabbi. Thank you. Love you so much. Thanks. Be well, Rabbi.
You're welcome. All right, again, the class will be put online shortly, so if you missed any part of the class, you can go to the audio link, and you'll be able to hear the class from the beginning. Okay.